major changes to the state's COVID-19 dashboard, a lawsuit against Todd Rokita over press access is over, plus e-learning limits and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 1st, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, the Indiana Department of Health made major changes to its COVID-19 dashboard, which includes removing information that had been available for much of the pandemic. The state says the changes that took effect Wednesday are part of its continued move towards surveillance of the virus rather than attempting to track every case. Gone will be daily updates. Instead, the dashboard will update Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Gone, too, is data that shows how many hospital beds and ventilators are available across the state. Now it will focus on how many people are hospitalized with COVID and compare that to previous periods during the pandemic. The state has also eliminated positivity rates with the update. Health officials say that's in response to changing standards. Because of the prevalence of at-home COVID tests and no reporting mechanism when those are positive, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is pushing states to move away from that metric. IDOH Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lindsay Weaver says the dashboard will focus on what she calls a better measurement, the impact COVID is having on the state's healthcare systems and hospitals. Do these changes signal a larger shift into a sort of post-COVID world? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Republican Ann Delaney, Democrat Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. That was, of course, a little April Fool's joke here on April 1st. Ann Delaney, are these...
Some weeks he can't tell, though.
I think her part just stopped there.
Yeah, Ann Delaney, are these changes to the dashboard a good thing?
Oh, I think they are. I think they're a representation or a recognition of the fact that we've moved beyond, and everybody has at-home test kits and doesn't report the results. So, I mean, it's important to keep an eye on the hospitalizations, and I assume the Department of Health is tracking which of the hospitalizations are COVID as opposed to the number of beds being occupied. So I think it's a progressive thing that reflects the concern that everybody would have that the system not be overwhelmed again if there's a new strain of the virus that comes forward.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, is this, like I said, part of a larger shift to sort of we're moving beyond this constant focus on COVID?
Yes, and hallelujah.
Amen.
2 years later, I mean, we've gone through this two-year process now. We have 90% of Americans over the age of 65 are fully vaccinated. 70% are in the 70s for those under. And we've talked about it a lot. At some point, this had to shift from the government keeping its finger on you to personal responsibility. And if you don't want to get sick, you don't want to be a part of that, you know, continued hospitalization for the unvaccinated, then you have to take it on yourself and not expect the government to continue putting these restrictions in place. You look at other parts of the world. China in particular is still going through massive lockdown, oppressive lockdowns, because they want a zero COVID policy, which is, you know, never going to happen there. And they're finding it impossible to manage. So we're well beyond that, and this needed to track that.
Nikki, one of the things they took away, though, was this is the percentage of available beds and ventilators statewide. And as journalists, I think that's something that we used a lot to sort of reflect this is how bad it's getting. We could never see it at they can see it, but we can't see it at an individual hospital level. But to sort of give Hoosiers, again, in the case of a future surge, this is how bad it's gotten. We don't really have that.
Yeah, anymore. I mean, in the past, we could say, for instance, in District 3 in Northeast Indiana, there were only 12 ICU beds left. Well, now we're not going to be able to say that because we won't know the top number of beds. And their, I guess, argument is, well, that number's not static. Like, it ebbs and flows. They can add beds, they take beds away, so they don't think it's very helpful. But I think for the public, it's massively helpful. I mean, otherwise, how do you properly explain if indeed the hospital is overwhelmed if you can't say how many beds they have and how many they have left?
Yeah, John, is the Department of Health arguably hurting itself by taking that number away in terms of communicating in a potential future surge how serious the situation is?
I suppose it would be great in an ideal world to have that data. I'm a fan
of
having...
Well, I mean, the data's there. Why not use it?
Well, that's making it available. And there are good things about this. It's ease of use, the fact that you can take different types of data sets and crunch them if you want to be play sociologist, and you can look at demographic groups and race and gender. So that's good. But yeah, if you had it there and you, it was available, why not? I mean, there's no reason not to. But it, you know, as we talk about moving beyond this, and we all certainly are happy about that, but we should remember one of the statistics that used to emerge from these daily updates was the number of Hoosiers who had perished because of this. And there, for 23,000 families, we may be moving on, but for them, there, I'm sure, will always be a hole in their lives, and we should remember that before we celebrate too enthusiastically, I suppose.
But, you know, if we do have another surge, there's nothing to say they can't come back with that information.
That's true.
Yeah. You know?
That's true.
And I also think that you'd have hospitals and the Hospital Association, which was very vocal back in December and January, sounding an alarm. I'm sure they wouldn't sit there on their hands. I'm sure we would hear from those folks if they sensed that there was something to panic about.
Well, a lawsuit against Attorney General Todd Rokita over press access is over. Rokita backed down after he barred longtime political writer Abdul Hakim Shabazz from attending his news conferences. Rokita claimed Shabazz was not a real journalist, calling him a gossip columnist. Shabazz has long had media credentials that give him access to the state government buildings in downtown Indianapolis, and no other political officials had barred him from their events, including Rokita's predecessors in the Attorney General's office. The ACLU sued Rokita on Shabazz's behalf, arguing the state's highest legal authority was in clear violation of the First Amendment. Now, the two sides have agreed to end the case, with Rokita agreeing to allow Shabazz to attend his news conferences like any other journalist. Mike O'Brien, what did Todd Rokita get out of this?
Not much. Right in the settlement was, Abdul's got to be able to go to, Abdul's a member of the press and has to be admitted to the press conference. You know, we live in this world right now where it is, you know, you guys are journalists. A lot of these people that are purporting to be journalists on television every day are not. It is like the, you know, shock jock, echo chamber media in a lot of places. But when you're elected officially, you just don't get to pick and choose who you think the media is and who it isn't. If they're credentialed and they're walking into the press conference, then don't have the press conference or do a sit-down interview with somebody you prefer to, you know, you think is going to write, you know, a better story or manage the questions on the front end or do any of the other strategies that, you know, if you don't like the coverage you're getting, that you can go and try to influence. But if you're an elected official and you're just going to hold a press conference, you don't get to pick and choose who gets to be in the room.
They say all publicity is good publicity. Is that really true here?
Well, I mean, Rokita doesn't care about having people say what a great job he's doing because he's doing a terrible job representing Indiana, frankly. But to his base, you know, he stood up to a black journalist who wasn't being fair to him. And I'm sure among his base, that probably earned him some brownie points. He had no leg to stand on. Mike is exactly right. If you're going to hold a press conference, everybody whose credentials get to go, whether they write favorable stories about you or not. So, I mean, he wasted time and resources on this, certainly. But then, frankly, that's probably time and resources he could have put to use in a more destructive way. So
he's also a conservative reporter.
Yeah, that's the really funny part.
This is Rachel Maddow. He was.
Yeah, this, yeah. That was the point that I think, you know, Attorney General Rokita kind of lost the battle. He's a Republican, Republican slash libertarian, Abdul is. And so he couldn't even say, like, well, I'm keeping the big bad liberal media out, you know. And so I'm not sure he gained anything. And frankly, it was probably something that was just sort of an afterthought, like, we don't want Abdul in here. They didn't think it through sort of the logical next step of would he actually, and when he got the ACLU to file the lawsuit on behalf of him, I'm sure that was a little bit of a shock.
I want to ask this, though, because the statement that his office sent out afterwards celebrated the end of the lawsuit because they're no longer spending tax dollars like they weren't the reason for the lawsuit
in the first place. Yeah.
But beyond that, it also continued to push this line that we can bar anybody we want from our private press conferences. So the fact that this lawsuit wasn't resolved in a way that they were forced to do something, it was a settlement. Are we going to face the same problem with Todd Rokita or another Indiana political officer in the future?
We may well, and it probably would be litigated again. And it's such a clear cut.
Result.
It's such a clear cut case that anybody who has a law degree, and I presume the Attorney General's law license is still active,
sure to practice.
I mean, it would be perhaps malpractice to engage willingly in this kind of lawsuit, knowing that what the outcome would be and the expense associated with it would be. But you ask what Todd Rokita would get out of it. And there's nothing as a practical matter, of course. But if you looked at that statement, Brandon, you just alluded to it, that went around the state, it was a chance to bang on this boogeyman, this sort of, you know, that he's created with, and we saw it with Donald Trump, too. He didn't use the word to describe the media that Donald Trump always used about enemy of the people, but everything else was right from the playbook. So you talked about how irrelevant reporters are, because now with technology, we can talk directly to voters, and we, the people, was these references to defending the public. And it really, you didn't have to infer much that it was, we were the enemy of the people, and journalists were somehow not only irrelevant, but an obstacle to the smooth functioning of our democracy. So to the extent that people
in
like that kind of, that kind of red meat to throw,
right,
even though it's BS.
And clearly not legal.
Well, he would do it aside anyway. From all of those things, there might be somebody who says, hey, thanks for standing up.
Yeah.
I suppose he probably already had those people on his side, though.
He probably did, but it gets him fired up.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. This week's question was, who came out the winner in Abdul Hakim Shahbaz's lawsuit against Attorney General Todd Rokita over press access? A, Abdul. B, Todd Rokita. C, both of them. Or D, neither of them. I know how I would vote. Last week's question, will Governor Eric Holcomb's veto of a bill banning transgender girls from girls' school sports hurt him politically? Just 33% of you say yes. 67% say no. I'm a little surprised at that one. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Schools will be, sorry about that. Schools will be limited to using just 3 e-learning or virtual learning days each year under a new Indiana law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports schools were surprised by the change, and one of the state's largest school districts says some will be challenged by it more than others.
The new law includes requirements for what a virtual learning day looks like, and if schools need more than 3 of them a school year, they'll have to apply for a waiver. But the sudden change by lawmakers has left many unanswered questions about how it will work. Fort Wayne Community Schools spokesperson Krista Stockman says disruptive weather, like snow, means some schools will likely have to navigate the limit more carefully than others.
It really hits the schools in the northern part of the state much more than the southern part of the state.
More information is coming soon, though. The Indiana Department of Education says it's building a virtual learning day certification process for schools if they need more flexibility.
John Schwanis, is this tie in the hands of schools too much?
Well, certainly that's what a lot of educators and administrators are saying is the fact, especially those in the northern part of the state where they're more susceptible to ice and snow and other sorts of things that might make it unwise to hold traditional school, traditional classes. The other thing, I guess, it sort of strikes me as I'm not sure what word to use, but there's some confusion about the messaging here, because you look at this bill, which surprised this law, a lot of people. And I went back and looked, and there was a bill introduced that would have done this, but it never got a hearing. Right. It was assigned to committee, never got a hearing. So at the same session, you have lawmakers telling school boards that they need to have public input and these sorts of formal process, but so that the public can weigh in on decisions before the school board votes and so forth. You have a measure that is going to affect a lot of school districts that never had a hearing, never, there was no opportunity for anybody pro, con, to weigh in on it at all. So you have a lot of people blindsided. And it was just one of many types of things that session. You have a session where people, you know, there were lawmakers who said, we need to return more power to schools. In fact, they can set their own licensing requirements or dispense with licensing requirements. And then you have this, which says, we're going to tell you what constitutes a virtual learning day and a traditional day, and you're going to adhere to it. So it just, I don't want to say schizophrenic, but it just seems that it's confused.
How much does this potential waiver process maybe blunt the impact of this?
I don't know yet, because we'll have to see what DOE says. I do want to say one thing, and I haven't looked that closely. It was in a bill with some other things. just because
school resource officers.
Right, yeah. But I mean, there were hearings on that bill. People could speak on that part of the bill throughout session. Just because the individual bill didn't get a hearing didn't mean people didn't come to it and speak on it in the bill it was in. Secondly, I'm just old school here. We somehow dealt with snow days before. You pad a couple onto your school year. Yeah. You know, and this still gives them an additional three for anything that could happen. So, and I think it recognizes that while we see e-learning as an opportunity for some times, we also saw when we used it too much that it results in some learning issues.
Yeah, I was going to say, the thing that struck me about this bill is it felt like after we had to use it so much, we'd learned so much, there were more resources available for e-learning because there had to be across the state. That's been part of the push for broadband expansion is we need these resources for schools. And yet those same things also, it seems, would probably be the reason for the bill itself, which is a lot of people didn't like that.
Yeah, I think it also reflects the schism within the Republican Party. I mean, there are those who think that kids ought to be homeschooled, and then there are those who think, you know, it's back and forth. And I don't know whether this is trying to do some kind of a balance. I don't think it was given enough attention. It was dumped in a bill with a lot of other things that drew a lot more public attention. And it is completely counter to all of their things about making decisions at the local level. I mean, nobody's talking about going back completely to e-learning now anyway. And so they don't have any evidence that it's being abused. And
well,
so what's magic about three?
I saw, for instance, a lot of districts this year were having trouble with bus drivers. And so they just would go e-learning constantly. Right. So that was happening more where, whether it be, you know, different reasons, they would just be like, oh, we'll do an e-learning day, no problem.
But when we had about COVID in that factor, too.
No, I'm talking about just recently.
Well, even recently, though.
So as we talk about trying to find, because I would think the goal is always balance, right? Hmm. Is just 3 days a little too much in one direction? Would it be more like you can't have X percentage of your days e-learning, something like that?
I think the DOE is going to figure out a way to make this practically, you know, they're going to implement it in a way that's practical. But I think this is also, I agree with Nikki, and I think it's a reflection of where State House Republicans were the last couple of sessions, where schools were relying heavily on e-learning for whatever reason. COVID certainly was the initial driver, but they've also gone to great lengths to make sure that schools weren't penalized. Particularly, you know, this past year when they were doing the daily counts, and you know, they do your student count your funding on it. They do that twice a year. First one's in September. Well, if you had a COVID outbreak and you exceeded the acceptable percent, you got knocked down to 85% funding, and you were considered kind of virtual learning. And they fixed that to make sure that this situation wasn't penalizing schools unfairly. And
yeah, I think they want to have to be doing that every single year now?
But I think
too.
They're trying to do. Well, and they don't have to.
Right.
And if the DOE gets this right, which I assume they will, they work obviously close with these school districts, just implement it in a way that's practical and balances it out and it's not being abused.
That's what you have to do. I mean, this is an overreaction for the fact that they wasted, $100 million up in Marion without adequate supervision of those virtual schools in the beginning, and now they're going the other way too far. Pendulum will swing back.
And I do think being in the classroom, I'm old-fashioned. I think you mentioned this too. I think you fare better in the classroom.
Absolutely.
I know I would learn better. I did learn better in the classroom.
Really?
Well, to the extent I learned.
Okay.
But I would have learned better. And I think we will see just the sort of the damage that was done, not through the fault of teachers tried, but this was thrust upon them. And, and some students didn't have access to the kind of high-speed internet that they needed. So for a number of circumstances, I'm not blaming anybody, but I think we can stipulate that kids do better in a classroom.
State police this week say they apprehended four teenagers who allegedly vandalized the Indiana State House.
News reports said the House chambers and other parts of the building were damaged Sunday, and a bench was thrown from a balcony. State police spokesperson Ron Galavis said three girls and one boy, ages 13 and 14, entered the building about 4 p.m. through one of the doors. They were caught after trying to flee from Capitol Police. Police are still investigating how they got inside. The building is closed to the public on Sundays.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm not going to focus on the vandalism. Vandalism is figuratively and literally, in this case, juvenile. But are there serious questions to be asked about security at the State House?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing that's bothering me is, you know, we're 5 days after it, and they still don't know how they got in. Like, I checked again just yesterday. They know what entrance they came in, but they can't explain how they got in. Now, it could be something literally as easy, and because I go into this entrance every day, Maybe the door didn't shut all the way. Sometimes, you know, you let it swing and it just catches, you know. But also the House chamber has its own locks, too. And so the how they got in, I at least haven't seen any reasonable explanation yet.
I mean, this isn't in a vacuum. A few years ago, we saw someone with a gun actually was able to get into the State House to go after, I think, if I remember correctly, the Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court. Now, that situation was thankfully resolved. No, that situation was thankfully resolved peacefully. But this isn't just a random building. This is a government building at a time when violence against the government is in vogue among some folks. So, I mean, are there serious questions to be asked?
Oh, I think so. And I think Nikki hit it on the head. If people knew how they'd gotten in and there was some lapse that could be corrected, and I'm sure eventually we will figure out what it was. That's one thing. But the notion of just how did this happen opens the door to a lot of people who might want to do something that's more egregious than breaking furniture and defacing property, as bad as that is. I mean, it's a departure from when I remember at the State House when there was, unless you were trying to get there after business hours, that's the only time you would encounter anybody asking you what you're doing. The rest of the time, any entrance was open, come, go. You could go through the tunnels from adjacent buildings.
Right.
And I guess those were simpler days. It's a shame that it's logical why we have the safeguards we have now. It's sad, though, that the people's house has to be a fortress of sorts.
Yeah, Mike, Nikki and I work, obviously, at the State House all the time. You work out of the State House pretty regularly. Your husband works out of the State House pretty regularly. Do you think we might see any more significant security measures that have to be put in place? Because it's certainly more than it used to be, but it's still, even compared to other state houses, not that stringent at the State House.
No, and it's always struck me as somewhat inconsistent. So, you know, in the tunnels that feed into the State House, underground tunnels, there's a state trooper there, and everybody who goes into that
at one of the
that
tunnels,
door,
there's a state trooper.
Right, and everyone that goes in that door has to scan their card. Whether there's five of y'all going in at once or not, you have to scan your card, and if you don't, they call you on it. That's not true in the other. There's like five other doors that like my key card works on that there's nobody, right? It's just right. Like, and I'm not trying to like, and we did, you know, during the Pence administration, he did have it pretty locked down. He had troopers at every door, had to check everybody's ID coming in if he had, you know, if you were bypassing the security. You know, so it's just struck me as over the year, I've been there for 22 years, it's just struck me as different and kind of inconsistent over the course of time.
I don't want to make too much out of this one incident. It was just vandalism. But this is something that those of us who work and spend time at the State House have noticed before, the inconsistency with security. Mm-hmm. Does more need to be done?
I think you probably need to in this climate. I mean, when you, for example, go into the Birch Bayh Federal Building, you can't get in a door that doesn't have massive security and guards. You can't do it. And that's not true at the State House. Either with the pass, with, you know, people, you know, being polite and holding the door for the people behind them. It happens. And those kinds of things, it seems to me, would not happen if each entrance were guarded. And that probably is what's going to have to happen.
What if everyone entering the State House was required to have a handgun?
Well, I think that is going to be the next.
Because then you basically have a police department that
could shoot it out with the 14-year-old.
Well, that's April. I don't know if that's April Fool's or not. Somebody might think that's a good idea.
It'll be interesting to see if there are any changes that come out of this. I don't know if there will be. But finally, all of the Indiana teams have been eliminated from the men's and women's March Madness tournaments. So, too, was many of our pick for the men's champion, Gonzaga. They were bounced a little before, I think, most of us thought. But, Mike O'Brien, I'll start with the men's. Who's going to be the men's 2022 Final Four champion?
Begrudgingly, Duke.
It makes a great story.
It's been too rigged for Coach K.
I want Nova. I want a team that isn't under some kind of investigation.
I can't root for anyone left. I'm just still on the St. Peter's
bandwagon.
Yeah. I wish they had found a way.
That would have been a wonderful story. But I guess among the stories that exist, the Coach K going out on a high note would be about the best story you can write.
I think hate is a word that's used a little too often. I don't care for Duke. I hate Kansas, on the other hand, so I'm rooting for Villanova.
Spoken like a guy who went to Missouri, right?
On the women's side, who do you have winning the women's?
Maybe UConn can finally not break lose early.
Yeah. No, I went to South Carolina.
Yeah.
Ooh, I would go UConn.
Yeah, that's probably the case. But her pick probably is the one to go with, because she was one of the people who ran the Women's Final Four when it was in Indianapolis. So she
so that gives me some
call
insight
her commissioners.
The,
well, it gives you okay. special insight, I'm
there
guessing.
There you go.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm actually right with you. I think South Carolina has looked exceptionally
good
all year. And UConn's had some close calls.
And I don't like that coach.
Gino Auriemma? Yeah, he...
Nope.
Reminds me a little of Coach K, actually. Incredible success, but...
Yeah, but not likable.
Kind of a jerk.
Have you checked his voting record yet, though?
No, I haven't checked his voting record. It has nothing to do with his politics.
Well, that would be a first
personality.
For
you, right? Yeah, I'm, we'll see if our picks this time do a little better than they did last time. So we all had IU going deep into the tournament. That didn't
at least
quite
I didn't have
out.
Gonzaga.
I'm going that team.
Yeah. All right. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Anne Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.